staff and his listeners for their support of KBOO Radio during this time. Democracy Now! Will return to the 4 p.m. slot on January 6th.
Oh, the little black train is coming. Get your business right. You better set your house in order, 'cause the train be here tonight. Go tell the fancy lady, all dressed in worldly pride, you better set your house in order and prepare to take a ride. Oh, the little black train is coming. Get your business right. You better set your house in order, 'cause the train be here tonight. Some men and some women care not for the gospel light, till the bell ring and the whistle blow of the little black train in sight. Oh, the little black train is coming. Get your business right. You better set your house in order, 'cause the train be here tonight. Oh, the little black train and its engine, with one little baggage car, has all your deeds and your wicked thoughts, gonna meet you at the judgment bar. Oh, the little black train is coming. Get your business right.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, the little black train, only it's a big, long black train.
Yeah, big, long black train.
Big, long black train full of oil.
Full of oil.
Or coal.
Or coal.
And there's no emergency setup for it.
It's like a rolling pipeline.
Yeah.
And nothing ever goes wrong with pipelines.
No, nothing goes wrong with pipelines, and especially nothing goes wrong with trains. Don't worry about Quebec. Don't worry about it. Don't think twice about the Dakotas. Don't worry about it.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program.
It is. This is.
I'm Abe and you are Joe. And
I am.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM on your dial.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about oil trains again today. I say again because we've talked about it before.
Well, we have. And I know you just hate talking about
it. No, I don't hate talking about it.
You hate it. You hate disaster.
Yeah, I do.
I love disaster.
Yes, I do hate disaster.
231-8187 is the number to call if you're a serious caller.
Okay, so what do oil trains have to do with Oregon? Well, they're passing through Oregon.
Well, that's the thing. They're passing through Oregon, and the railroads really aren't very forthcoming about what measures they have ready to deal with any kind of potential disaster. There's a basic rule in industry: what can go wrong will go wrong.
Yeah,
and we know that trains derail. We know that the lines maintained by the Burlington Northern Santa Fe and the lines maintained by the Union Pacific are old fashioned. They're not the most modern rail setup. And we know that many of the rail cars, particularly oil cars, are not the modern cars that have double liners or have various ways of preventing oil from spilling should the trains derail. This is what we know. We also know that hundreds upon hundreds of these trains will be passing through the Northwest on their way to the port. I love this because it's a port you've never heard of. The port of Westward,
near
Clatskanie.
Hundreds upon hundreds might be a little bit of an exaggeration.
No.
There were 110 last year.
Yeah, but it's going to continue to grow.
Yeah, it will. The growth part is important to note, but there were almost none as recently as 2008, and 110 of them last year. And if a proposed rail oil terminal is built near Vancouver, that terminal could handle 4 trains per day.
Per day?
Per day.
How many cars on a train?
I don't know.
Lots.
I don't know. How many angels on the head of a pin?
Yeah, right. The answer is lots.
Lots.
Lots, yes. That's science for you.
That's science.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And the thing is that there's there's this tendency to say, well, the oil industry, gosh, they must be responsible. The energy industry is very responsible. And I simply give you West Virginia.
Yes, or the Deepwater Horizon.
Yes, or the Valdez.
Right, or the sinkhole in Alabama.
or any of a number of disasters
yes.
Perpetrated by the oil industry and the coal industry. And we are supposed to have faith.
We are supposed to have faith. That becomes increasingly difficult to justify that faith, however, when you consider a number of factors, not the least of which is the fact that in Oregon, transporting crude oil by train is virtually unregulated.
Unregulated.
Compared to any other method of transport that you might undertake.
But surely that's like a free enterprise. That's free enterprise.
Yeah, yeah. But
very free.
Free enterprise has a history of cutting corners.
Well, yeah. Profit being the sole, if not, you know, the sole motive, really.
Yeah, the sole motive.
Okay, so here's the situation, folks. Trains are going to be coming through the city of Portland, through the city of Vancouver. Many are going to be terminating at Vancouver. These trains will unload crude oil. Some they will also be, of course, coal. And these fuels will be in our air, in our environment, in our world, on the rails. And we have no way to control that.
Right.
And all of this is part of this grand scheme to create a one, I love this because it absolutely fits the paranoia of so many, one world economic system. It makes you laugh, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I'd say we already have a one world economic system. We have for some time.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, the question is only one of degree now, the extent to which that system absorbs local systems into itself.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in whether people who listen regularly to KBOO are concerned about these oil trains. And I'm interested also in whether or not people really appreciate this increase in oil trains. You say, well, there weren't any in 08. Now there are what, how many?
There were 110 last year.
110 last year, and there's plans to be many, many more, 300, something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah, and a lot of them are going to stop actually in Vancouver. And the thing to know, of course, is apart from the very clear danger of an accident, there is the normal shifting of fuel from one source, one container to another, which involves releasing all kinds of toxins.
Yeah, this is true.
So what are we going to do?
Well, if it were up to me.
Or is it up to you?
If I were the dictator.
Yes.
I would disallow a rail transport of crude oil.
You would do, what would you do? Put a pipe in?
No, just don't bring it through here. No.
But
you're going to get dirty oil out of North Dakota, which is where this oil is coming from.
Yeah.
This is very
it's shale oil.
Yeah, shale oil, very similar to what they're extracting in Canada a little farther north.
Yeah.
This is very dirty, and if you're taking it out of North Dakota and you need some place to ship it from, well, I would say find another place. Or even better, don't take it out of the ground at all. Find another way to generate the energy you need.
But generating the energy we need through the more modern techniques of using the sun or the wind, that's not what's happening.
I would dispute the fact that those are modern energy generation techniques.
Ah.
We've been using sun to grow crops for thousands of years.
That's true.
And we've used the wind to move ships for hundreds of years, if not thousands.
Right. And we've had windmills in many
yes,
places.
Yes, indeed we have. These are not new concepts. There are new technologies that do it more efficiently.
Yes.
But these are our old and indeed our original sources of energy.
So what we're really looking at is what? A modern energy system based on extraction of ancient dead animals out of the earth?
Yes, we do. But that's sort of an antecedent to something else, which is a global economic system that is predicated on continuing unlimited growth. The problem is that global economic system, which we call capitalism, exists within a closed biosphere, which means that in order for the system to work, it has to expand infinitely forever. We don't have an infinite number of resources, an infinite number of space, infinite amount of space on this planet. They don't coexist. They cannot coexist. It is a doomed proposition.
Well, doomed when? How?
Well, we don't know for sure, but the predominance of scientific opinion seems to indicate that a temperature tipping point in terms of climate change caused by the powering of this global economic system, we'll probably reach that tipping point sometime this century, after which conditions will fundamentally change, and if not, wipe out our species, severely deplete it, and relocate much of it.
Oh, you're making me depressed.
Well, this is the truth. This is the truth. We cannot keep powering global capitalism with the combustion of fossil fuels. It's simply not a going proposition.
But that's you're putting forward a radical proposition. You're suggesting actually altering the fundamental values of our society.
Not really, no. I'm just saying we should find a different way to power it.
Oh.
We are an advanced industrial civilization. I don't think that's going to go anywhere. Here's a test for that. You want a test?
I want a
test.
To
see if our
industrial...
Okay. If you're hearing the sound of my voice right now...
Yes.
I want you to raise your hand. Okay?
Okay. All right. My hand's up.
Okay. Now look around.
Those of you who don't see me, it's my hands up.
Okay. Those of you with your hands in the air...
Yes.
...are hearing me either on the radio...
Yes.
...or over the internet.
Yes.
Both of which are the products of an advanced industrial civilization.
Uh-huh.
That ain't going anywhere. We've passed that tipping point a long time ago. What we need to do is figure out a better way to power this global economic system.
Okay. I don't want to open up a conversation of a fantastic science fiction-y nature and have people call, well, we can do this or we can do that. That's not. I really am concerned that there is no regulation of these rail cars for right now, today.
Okay.
That there is no adequate firefighting preparation for these rail cars.
Okay.
Because I believe in Murphy's Law. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And that really the railroads are not forthcoming. They're not telling how many trains. They're not telling how many cars. They're not telling what their plans are in the event, I believe, the inevitable event of a disaster of some kind, or at least a derailment down the line.
Yeah, in fact, the planning to respond for an oil-based or a train-based oil spill, they're just beginning. We really don't have a plan in place.
Right.
If there's a major derailment, we're not prepared for it.
And what we know from our experience with fossil fuels in the last 20 years or so is that things really do go wrong, and things really will go wrong. And there's no the people who are in power were not the civic not the civic people, not the governments of the cities, not the governments of the states, not the government of the United States. They don't really have any plan.
No, they don't.
So if the rail companies are trying to maximize their profits and the oil industry wants to maximize its profits and they already have oil cars, why the hell should they put in safer oil cars?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so it's like a ticking bomb.
Yeah, putting in safer rail cars, that
would help. That would help.
That doesn't help your share value. No, it doesn't.
It doesn't?
No.
No, of course not.
Yeah. But hey, here's the irony. You know what else doesn't help your share value?
What?
Massive derailments and huge accidents. That doesn't help your share value either.
Well, there's that. There's some kind of formula you think that the economists could come up with, X number of rail car derailments equal Y reduction in share
value. Oh, yeah.
Value.
You know, I think that's probably exactly such a formula. Some sort of actuarial table that tells the train corporation exactly how much they should invest in safety in order to still maximize its bottom line. Any more larger investment in safety, the odds are it's not going to be worth it.
You know, I don't know why I should stop doing radio. I get depressed.
It's
depressing.
There's another bigger irony at the end of the line or the rail. And that is that this oil is leaving. It leaves our shores. It goes across the Pacific.
But it goes away.
No, it goes to drive global capitalism in places like China and India, and they burn it. And then it goes up in the air and it makes the planet hotter. So it ends up poisoning us and warming us anyway, if it's not being used here.
It's like I say, I don't know why I do this.
I don't know.
It's just,
Yeah.
Yeah.
503-231-8187. Should we take a phone call?
Yeah, let's take a
Greg,
phone call.
What's up? Hello.
Hey guys, just wanted to make a little public service announcement.
Okay.
You really should have everyone listening out there read... Amory Lovin's book, Reinventing Fire, and he gives the economic benefits of changing over to a carbon-free, nuclear-free society.
Well, I appreciate that, and I by the way think it's a good book, and I think it's a valuable resource. So thanks a lot, man.
And then the other one Not book number two. You thought you were just going to read one book, huh?
Yeah, I thought.
Yeah, and I told you this one earlier, Joe, and I bet you didn't read it yet.
Nope.
It was Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy by Arjun Marjani, a Ph.D.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a free download electronic version you can get off the net. So if you read both of those, you're pretty well up on what can be done, and very possible, not some sort of science fiction stuff.
Possible, but, you know, the profit, what drives the corporations is fast profit and stock prices and stuff like that, and all of that is quick.
Right, but that's why you want to read Amory Lovin's book, because he gives the economic arguments for and how much money these corporations could save by becoming energy efficient.
Wow,
it's really pretty powerful. It's pretty powerful. I mean, it's almost a no-brainer, but people have got to take the step and actually do it. I mean,
yeah, no, I really appreciate the call, and I appreciate the suggestion of the two books, even if I am lazy.
And then hopefully we won't have any coal trains.
No more coal trains.
Yeah.
Well, what are we going to do with the tracks? Oh, I know, high-speed rail for people.
Sure. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, man. All right, so here's what's interesting: the Oregonian. The disappearing newspaper, right? This Sunday had a big, big front page story on oil train regulators get crude awakening, which essentially says, you know, the oil industry is moving these trains, and the coal industry is moving these trains, and the cities and the counties and the states and the federal government are completely unprepared for it. And this is the Oregonian, the innately conservative pro-business Oregonian. So, you know. Well, what we know is that the news is bad, worthy of a front page of the Oregonian. And yet, most of us in our quotidian lives don't think about this stuff.
Quotidian.
That's a very fancy word.
It is pretty fancy.
I like that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know. Maybe we should just stop and talk about the TPP or some other disaster.
It's not going to make this go away.
No, I suppose not. I suppose we should need it. We need it. What I believe is happening is we are, as a society, suffering from a severe, overwhelming sense of hopelessness in the face of looming economic and environmental disaster. And people are just, it's like battle fatigue. You know, it's like we're fatigued. We can't handle it anymore.
That's bad.
Well, am I wrong?
Because that ain't going to get the job done.
No, I agree. But, you know, do you think my terrible, cynical attitude is wrong?
No, I don't think it's wrong.
Ah!
I can tell you my personal experience. I tend to vacillate between feeling hopeful and then feeling this overwhelming sense of helplessness.
You have children.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I do. And I think that intensifies the vacillation. Because on the one hand, I hear them talk about... you know, how life ought to be and how we ought to organize things and the choices we ought to make. And they're young and that hopefully they're going to live by these things they're saying the rest of their life. And that gives me hope.
Yeah.
But
children are cute.
They are quite cute. But at the same time, you know, you do the math. You look at the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
You look at the inexorable rising average global temperature and you go, God, we can't do anything about this. There isn't enough we could do at this point in the game. We're too far gone.
Yeah.
So that's how I vacillate.
That's a vacillation?
It is.
Not much of a vacillation.
Yeah, it is. I go from, yes, we're going to be able to turn this around. Look at these brilliant, smart young people who know what to do, whose heads and hearts are in the right place. That gives me hope. But then the math makes me hopeless.
And then, but on the other hand, we're not teaching any of this stuff in schools.
Oh, but we are.
We are?
Oh, yes.
We are.
Yeah, I have a son who's about to finish the public high school system here in the Portland area.
Yeah.
And he received explicit scientific-based instruction about the reality of global warming in a number of science courses along the way. Yes, both in junior high and in high school.
Ah, you see, so I'm my dark side is just built on ignorance?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, yes, there are crazy deniers in this country who say global warming ain't true.
Yeah.
But to their credit, there are scientists who teach science, who are saying this is true. So, there is reason to be hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 300 cars coming through, 300 trains coming through.
But there are things we can do. We can stop. We can stop this terminal from being built in Vancouver.
Can we?
We can certainly try.
I see that so far there's no success in reducing it. And the irony is that working people, people who want a living wage, desperately need the jobs that that terminal, for example, will provide.
Yeah, yes, people do need jobs. In fact, that's one of the big problems right now. People ain't got no jobs.
Yeah.
But there aren't going to be all that many jobs at this terminal. There'll be some building it.
Yeah.
Those will go away once it's built.
Right.
And there'll be some operating and maintaining it, but not all that many. And certainly, I don't think enough to justify this continuation of the combustible ways that have gotten into this mess.
Well, I, of course, agree with you, but, well, maybe we should hear from our listeners. 231-8187.
Who's up? Dan, good morning.
Morning. I'm calling from close to Intel, sort of under the shadow of the plume.
Ah.
Anyway, I agree with you guys about the trains and all other symptoms of the world economic situation. But at the same time, we have to be practical about those things. I think the fundamental problem is growth. And it doesn't matter what sort of energy source you develop or technology, how efficient it is straight from the sun, if that is used for more growth, you've got the same fundamental problem. So that's just the position that I take.
So, in other words, no matter what we do, if we have more of us, there's going to be more problems. If there's more of us, there will be more problems. Is what you're saying, I think.
Yes.
Are you
yes.
talking about the growth of human population or the growth of the economic system?
Well, our economic system is kind of tied to more customers all the time, or products that fail. But
yeah,
I think that when virtue is valued more than how much can I get, and the general welfare becomes more important somehow, we get closer to something with a lot more smiles on people's faces.
Well, that's, you know, I think you're right. I just don't know how we make that really happen in the system that's so dominated by short-term profit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it takes failure. We're working on that.
Okay. Hey,
all right.
Thanks for the call.
I think there's a few basic steps we can take, and we'll get to those in a little while.
Okay.
Let's take a few more calls.
All right.
All right. Who's next? Randall, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hey.
Hey, I have some FYI for you guys.
Okay.
Okay, hey, the facility out there in Klaskanai was built in 2006, 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And that was originally an ethanol facility.
Really?
So over the years, they've closed that ethanol facility down. It only made about a year's worth of ethanol. And now they've converted it into an oil storage facility.
Okay.
Okay, and then the other, on the Port of Vancouver, they will be spending $100 million to build this new tank farm and transfer plant in the next 24 months.
Wow.
Hmm.
Also, the Coos Bay project, that LNG plant, is going to go. It's going to happen.
Really? And that's going to involve a huge rail transportation system, too.
Well, they're going to be building a pipeline.
Pipeline.
From Southern Oregon to Coos Bay to transfer all that that fuel into the ships, into the docks.
Okay, so you've really cheered me up.
So, but seriously, the pipeline, instead of rail cars, they should pipeline it. That's more safer, and I know we hate hearing that, but it is more safer. Okay, guys.
All right, thanks for the call. You know, he is right about the pipelines being more safe. Yes, however, the pipelines, it turns out, fail. They're not adequately inspected. Frequently, they're underground. They leak. They blow up.
Yeah, that comparison though, is a little bit like asking, do you want to get cancer from smoking or from chewing tobacco? Well, either way, you're going to get cancer.
Either way.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you've, again, cheered me up.
Yeah,
I want to thank you that.
Right, let's go back to the phones.
All right.
Harvey, good morning.
Hi, Abe and Joe. Great show this morning.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to add a positive, some positive.
Yeah, positive. Give me positive. I need positive.
Okay, well, the key to me is no using any water to generate electricity. And as you know, the coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear are second only to agriculture in their daily use of our freshwater resources.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm into photovoltaic, which is light to electricity, like solar panels.
Yeah.
I'm into piezoelectric. That's spelled P-I-E-Z-O, electric.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's pressure to electricity, direct. I'm into thermoelectric. That's heat to electricity. All these are solid-state devices that convert pressure, heat, and light into electricity and don't use any water in there. But there's one that is, you know, they're working on it now. And the reason that they could possibly bring it into being is because we're working on the nanoscale now. So the next one would be the atmospheric electricity generation. It turns out that the Earth is one magnet, the ionosphere is another, and between them creates this giant dynamo.
That's right. And the Earth is spinning. How convenient.
And if you look up Google for free electrons, it turns out that there's zillion trillion free electrons because of the movement. And also, I don't know if you know it, but the Earth is rotating faster than the atmosphere, and that drag also creates free electrons.
Right.
And so there's also free electrons in the ocean. As the ocean moves around, there's tons of free electrons. So the trick is to get a device that could absorb or harvest these free electrons. And up till now, it's sort of like it was Tesla's dream. It's been kind of hard to achieve. But on the nanoscale, using fractal antennas, what is known as fractal antennas on the nanoscale, there is the possibility of being able to harvest these free electrons from the atmosphere and the ocean. So this will create a really endless source of electricity, along with photovoltaics, piezoelectric, thermoelectric, wave power, hydrothermal, and all that. And so we do have the potential of really entering into a state of abundance and away from the four horsemen of the apocalypse: coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear, which have a killer, a death hold on the planet right now.
Well, you know, I are these things all? Is the technology for these things already there, or is this about research?
The technology for thermoelectric, piezoelectric, and photovoltaic are already there. They're being employed. The atmospheric electricity generation, or harvesting electrons from the atmosphere and the ocean, is being worked on right now. I don't know. One could always do research on the web, but I don't think there's any practical models of it. But there is research being done on the nanoscale on that. And if they can crack it, if they can break it open, then that would be really because the Earth itself is just like a giant motor. It's a motor within a rotor, And
I like that, motor within a rotor. It sounds right.
Rotor within a motor. So that could be, just the rotation of the Earth and all the friction sets up could be an endless source of free electrons in the atmosphere. So this is the potential of the near future, and we already have a good portion of it. One way, for instance, that photovoltaic, piezoelectric, and thermoelectric can work together, it's an idea I had, is called the Aqua Solar Panel. You know these touch screens on touch phones, telephones now, and touch screens on computers? Well, that's a thermoelectric touch screen. It's transparent. It's a piezoelectric. So every time you tap your finger on it, it's like pressure. Well, so you can have a cover on a solar panel that is a piezoelectric cover, and when it rains, the pressure of the raindrops creates electricity, and then usually solar cells are sort of grayish or brownish or cobalt blue. They attract a lot of heat, so you can have a thermoelectric device under the solar cell to turn the excess heat into electricity. So this would be a piezoelectric, photovoltaic, thermoelectric solar panel.
I love it.
The Aqua Solar Panel.
I love it.
So that's utilizing three of these technologies right there in one device. Pressure, heat, and light.
Of course, the question is, can it be made economically advantageous to capitalism?
Well, everything can be made economically if it's for mass production. Then they just figure it out and then they tweak it up to economic level, like they did solar panels. It used to be something like $7 a watt, and now it's 70 cents a watt for solar. It's really gone way down. So it's just a matter of tweaking it that way. So that's the thing. If you want to go to Google, put in atmospheric electricity generation and start looking around. I think you'll be surprised at how much work has already been put into that area.
Well, I really thank you. You may have cheered me up.
Good.
Hey, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You bet. That was a great call.
Bye-bye.
No, that's good. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, this is all, when I was a kid, I used to get Scientific American, and I used to get all those, you know, kind of cool magazines that teenage boys get, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I'd read about all these future things.
Yeah, older boys get them too.
Older boys, grown up boys.
That's right.
Even grown up girls too.
That's right.
And I used to really think that there would be this wonderful science fiction world.
Well, in many ways, we're living in it. Last night, I'm holding a smartphone in my hands. This is great radio. Last night, I
look, a smartphone.
Yeah,
small object. What is it? 1.5 inches by three?
Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, last night I video chatted, called with my folks in California, and they got to talk to their new grandson and see him.
Yes.
And you know, hear him.
What did he say?
He made some baby sounds.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the stuff of sci-fi. Is the point I'm trying to make.
Ah.
Okay. So, following on the caller statements. This isn't out of reach. We do have ways to redeem ourselves here. The giant irony in all this is the very thing that got us into this problem, technology,
yes,
is the very thing that can get us out of this problem.
Aha.
It's a question of two things, collective will and individual decisions. Collective will in this respect. I heard a radio story this morning about Denmark, which during the month of December generated more than half of its electricity from wind power. The first time that had ever happened in any jurisdiction.
Yeah.
The official who was interviewed as part of the story said, it was just a question of will. We just decided that we were going to forego combustion as the primary means of energy generation, and we were going to do this thing, and now it is working.
Does it whack birds?
I don't know.
Okay, sorry.
I don't know. Collective will and individual decisions. So we need to decide collectively that this is how we're going to do things.
But how do we get control of the, I hate to sound kind of Marxist here, but how do we get control of the means of production so that the immediate capitalist system, which is not interested, I don't think, in any of these new technologies.
No, not until they're profitable.
Right. How do we get control? I mean,
well, I think that's where the individual decisions come in. We vote each and every day when we spend our money.
Uh-huh.
The things we spend our money tell the producers of those things that they are worthy of being produced. So if we spend our money on the right sorts of things, and here's the kicker, if we choose not to spend money on the wrong sorts of things, or to flip that around a little bit, we start doing for ourselves, providing ourselves with things like food, instead of buying it from others. It's the net effect, the cumulative effect of all those individual decisions that can start to nudge the system in the right direction.
So you're
how we begin to take control of the means of production.
So you're hopeful.
Yes.
Of a non-revolutionary but rather evolutionary approach to dealing with the environment and with energy needs.
Yes. Yes, I am hopeful for an evolutionary approach. However, it's likely that revolution will rear its head somewhere along the line.
Subways got flooded.
Things are going to get worse before they get better.
All right, let's hear from our phone callers. 231-8187.
Harry, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
Yes, I saw an article about a month or so ago on television. It was about the city of Portland hired this company to put turbines on the water flow from Bull Run to our water system.
Uh-huh.
And since Of course, gravity, you know, water flows downhill.
Right.
It's actually making electricity,
uh-huh,
which they are, but they didn't say how much electricity or who actually got the payment for it.
Right. Well, I think that's really an important point. There are a lot of ways to create a multi-use or multi-phase approach to any movement of any sort of water or any, or air or any of these things.
Yeah, and that's, and, you know, they've been destroying dams, but I know in Europe and probably here in the United States, we'll be putting more power plants where they'll just take water from the river, go through the turbine, and then put it back into the river again. The first electrical power plants were like that on the Niagara River on Niagara Falls.
Yeah, you know, it does warm up the water, those processes. But yes, you're right. I mean, these are ways in which we can create electricity or other forms of energy with an initial investment and then maintenance, and become very, over the long term, very cheap, if not free.
Yeah, Yeah. The next comment I have you noticed that all our pollution here in Oregon is coming from the state of Washington?
All of it, huh?
Yeah,
not
well,
all of
not,
it.
I mean, a lot of it. I mean, example, the coal trains. They're not coming through Oregon. They're going through Washington. The oil trains that you were talking about, they're going through Washington.
Well, actually they go through Oregon and they cross the Columbia right here in Portland.
Oh, they do?
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah, they do. And then they run up to Clatskanie, et cetera. No, there also are trains on this side, completely on this side. Remember, there's two rail lines, one on each side of Columbia, and that basically right now the system is such that the trains stay on the Washington side until they get to Portland, and amazingly they cross the rail bridge here and move on up the Columbia River.
Oh, okay.
Or on down the Columbia River.
Yeah, and don't forget, the state of Washington also has Hanford, which is polluting us too.
Well, Hanford with its disastrous residue from nuclear weapons. Yes, that's true. But you're bringing me back to my depressed state.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay. Well, okay, think positive.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for the call. All right, 2318187.
Hey. That's right, listeners, your job here is to cheer Joe up.
Yes, that's our job. That's our worldwide task is to make me feel better.
Don't let Joe have a sad.
No sad. And I, you know, we're not, again, not hearing a lot from women on this topic, I guess.
No.
Oh, we have some women callers.
Anita, good morning.
Good morning. Actually, I live in Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very close to the rail lines. In fact, I'm in the blast zone.
What's that mean?
Oh, my.
Oh, well, of course, as you both are well aware, we've had three exploding trains within 6 months. There was the one in Quebec that killed 47 people.
Yes,
right.
And then there was the one outside of Alice, I believe it was, Alabama, back in November.
Yes.
Right.
That everybody seems to have forgotten about because it did not cause 47 deaths and it did not apparently cause enough of a stir in the media to...
Well, it's Alabama, you know. Mm.
Well, I suppose. But in any case,
yes.
Of course, then we get the North Dakota explosion.
Right.
The exploding train. That's
a couple
our third
of weeks
exploding
ago.
Train.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, just before New Year's, as I recall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you talked about the rail cars and the 111s that are the super exploding models, which are supposed to be phased out. Well,
right.
That's very nice, except that it was reported reliably that the cars on that Alice train, Alice, Alabama train, were the newer, safer cars.
Oh, really?
That's what... you know, a friend of mine who does some serious research on this sort of thing found out. So I thought that was really fascinating import. And then, of course, this last one, which actually got the EPA's attention, which was the first bit of good news I'd heard that, you know, we ought to label this as hazardous material and treat it as such. Those are, you know, it's helpful to remember that it wasn't just two exploding mm-hmm. oil trains, but three in the last 6 months. And then there was the other little matter that the coal trains, when the coal falls off of the rail cars, it degrades the rail beds and ups the chances for derailment.
Oh, I didn't realize. So it's like an interaction of the acids in the coal itself?
I'm not quite sure what it is, but that was also something that I understand used to be on the BNSF website or something, but it's not there now, as I understand it. So that will require a little more digging. But we get these lovely degraded rail beds with the problems of derailing coal cars, which can certainly happen, and then we're putting... these oil trains on those same degraded rail beds, and sending them right through here.
Well, I have to ask, are people in Vancouver at all concerned about this plan?
I was deeply impressed with how many people came out for the last chance to testify before the port, not the Port Authority, the environmental agency people.
Uh-huh.
At the moment, EFSEC, Environmental Facility Site Evaluation Council people.
Right.
There were so many that they had to cut off testimony after 80 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And since, you know, there were well over 100 people in line, there were people who didn't even get to testify on this, who'd spent some time working on testimony. Not only that, but they had to cut down the time allotted for testimony from 3 minutes to two, which it showed, shall we say, quite a bit of interest. The problem is that there's just not yet enough awareness of the impending disaster here. It is possible to let our governor know about this, and Governor Inslee, and I think there's some hope that he might listen. So I thought I would add that to the
Well, I'm really glad you did call about it. We Governor Kitzhaber over here doesn't seem able to. He has been eaten by a slug, and I don't know. I don't know that anything can help over here, but we'll see. We'll see. You know, he's going to run for the unprecedented fourth term, so I don't know. Anyway, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you very much for covering this.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
okay.
It's nice to get
there. Okay, we're going to go to some more callers, but first.
Yes, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, Sanyo Tree, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, talks about the end of the drug war. At 10, Chris Andre Hills, Air Cascadia headlines.
Wait, Maria, the end of the drug war?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Chris Andre Hills, host Air Cascadia at 10, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman reports that the U.S. sailors wounded by Fukushima are getting sicker by the day. And Gareth Porter says former Defense Secretary Robert Gates conceals the real story of gaming Obama on the Afghan War in his new book. At 11 on stage in studio, Dimay Roberts hosts a preview of David Henry Hwang's play Chinglish. She talks with director May Adrales and actress Tina Chilip and Peter O'Connor about the challenges of a bilingual Chinese-English play. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Ava Lake interviews Ruth Gunther, chief curator of the Portland Art Museum, about the Francis Bacon portrait of Lucian Freud, which is currently on display at the museum.
Yeah, it's like four pictures of distorted people.
I don't know who Lucian Freud is.
You don't?
No.
Oh.
I know who Sigmund Freud is.
Okay.
Anyway, well, some more coming up today on KBOO.
All right. Yes, lots of stuff to do and see. I went and saw the samurai armor.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
I need to go see that before it leaves.
It's too late.
Oh, it's too late?
Oh, yeah.
Man, I wanted to see that.
Yeah, this last weekend was it. But all right, let's talk some more about the oil trains coming down up the gorge. Talk about them.
Pam, good morning.
Good morning. I am so happy that you have this on the air. And I have to say, I've been thinking here, boy, I'd love to be talking to all these people calling in. And the radio is, your show is the closest we can get to getting in a room together. So I thank you for that. I think
you bet.
KBOO. I live on the peninsula in North Portland, right next to the tracks, more or less, as do people who live much closer to the tracks. And I recently went to a meeting of first responders, a conference, an all-day conference. It was, I'm told it was a, quote, high-level conference. Present were people from BNSF, and I guess it's Union Pacific.
That's yes, Burlington Northern Santa Fe.
Right.
And the Union Pacific Railroad, yeah.
And the Coast Guard. It was for first responders, except that there were some people there that I didn't hear from who weren't there, such as hospital people.
Ah.
Anyway, the biggest, most exciting topic they had, frankly, was at the end of this conference when they, after they had talked about the difficulties of cleaning up Bakken oil from the waterways, was who would take charge and be the main gatekeeper for any information coming out of something. Not how will we get aid to people who are, you know, when the Bakken oil explodes because of the chemicals in it, which make it give it a lower flash point than gasoline.
Yes, and that's really important. That's really important for people to understand.
That was their biggest topic, fighting over who would be the big dog.
Well, you know, they have a vested interest in being the deciders.
I guess it was kind of scary, frankly.
Huh.
And one of the
yes.
I'm sorry. Something I've noticed is let's talk about Vancouver's responsibility and Washington State. Washington State, I've compared. I went to their scoping meetings that your last caller Anita spoke about.
Uh-huh.
Their scoping meetings are far better and more polite to people, and more humane and more interesting, frankly, more participatory than anything that the DEQ has ever put on here.
Really?
Definitely. Mm. If you try it and go to one of their they're respectful of people. They give everybody a chance to talk, and they have several different ways of getting your comments in, and they have court reporters there to take down your what you say. I mean, it's a really well thought out process, and they have everybody on their board, including the people that you don't like, such as the Port of Portland commissioners, Port of Seattle commissioners,
uh-huh.
the port commissioners.
Yeah.
And the people who stand to gain money by this thing. Finally, one of the things, something that I think we need to pay attention to as activists, citizen activists, is the we need to find out what the rank and file union guys who will benefit from this stuff, what they think.
And how much they know, how much they actually get to know about it. Yeah.
And how much, I think if they took the bit in their teeth, we might wind up with some decent democratic unions, labor organizations, because I think a lot of times the labor organizations involved are just as, if you recall, they're just as...
Hidebound?
Hidebound, exactly.
Yes.
As... corporations. And speaking of pipelines, which nobody is, I mean, I shouldn't be, Kinder Morgan here in Portland has quite a presence, and they stink up North Portland to no end, and Kinder Morgan is the remnants of Enron. They're tremendously filthy rich, and they have a horrible history of polluting the air and in Texas and elsewhere, and a lot of the pipelines that have leaked up in Canada, they might not have built them, which they would be the ones building them here and maintaining them, I imagine, but they've been Kinder Morgan's pipelines.
Well, that is interesting.
I
should look that up, and I know very little actually about that. I know that the solution, the alternative to rail cars, ironically, is pipelines, and pipelines represent their own set of problems.
Well, I think that our legislator kind of put paid to hope there when they made it possible, more possible, for pipelines to take farmlands, to, you know, people's land, to build these things.
Right. Eminent domain is the yeah. weapon of large capital and
right.
State governments.
Right.
It's true.
So thank you very much. I would really dearly love to get, if we could all just really organize around this in Portland. It's a tremendously, you know, you can see the Bakken oil fields from space now, and you can also light the tundra on fire now.
Well, I think that's good. A tundra fire, that would be very cool, very
tundra
colorful.
It's a very wet place. It's a friggin' swamp.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, thank
hey,
you very much for the call.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah. You know,
boy, our callers have been tearing it up today.
I've got good callers. I think that this is something that people are very aware of, at least a significant minority of people, and I hope that this show helps to fuel concern and activity, you know, organization and environmental involvement. Because I think it's really crucial. If you, with your positive attitude, Abe, are right, then maybe people can pressure capital to change its ways. If I'm right, we're doomed.
Yep. Well, let's go with me being right.
Okay, let's go
All
with
right.
you being right. 2318187. We got time.
Garrett, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
She brought up eminent domain. And I never actually heard of anyone using eminent domain on these clean energy patents to get bought up and locked away for no one to ever use ever again.
Well, that's probably true.
But I was actually curious if anyone knows where I could get solar panels for a house, because I keep calling around to these different places that claim to set up solar panels on your roof.
Uh-huh.
And they all seem to be locked into some kind of scheme where the panel will feed directly into the grid.
Right.
And you get to buy it back from the grid. They'll pay you a fraction of the price that you're paying them for the power coming from your own panel.
Wait a minute. You mean you can't just drop out of the grid and have your own solar set up?
I have asked a lot of different companies about that, and it seems like they're all reading from the same script. They automatically start saying, what are you, some kind of conspiracy theorist? Are you trying to get off the grid?
I know of only one house in Portland that I talked to the owner. This is in the Southwest, who says he got off the grid. Now, I never talked to him about how he did it or what happened, but he got so angry at the electric companies that he just somehow got out of the system. But that was years ago.
Well, I don't know what's going on, but they really do seem to be using the same script. They're using the same kind of demeaning tactics to try and talk you into feeding into the grid. They don't want you to be off the grid, and they'll talk down to you and try and make you feel like an idiot for even wanting it.
That's interesting. I have not checked into this, but I think I will. Now that you've hit me to it, you know? Very interesting. Thanks for the call, man.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, well, that's sort
Boy, there's bullies at every level and every venue, aren't there?
Oh, I'm so pleased.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so sarcastic. No, I think the calls have been really good. I've got time for a couple
more. Yeah, let's take some more. Mike, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Listen, I just wanted to... You know, not to make Joe happy about this, but the thing about the oil trains coming through the gorge is that there was an oil spill in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a couple of years ago, which was tar sands oil, and some of that would be coming on these trains.
Right.
And the curious thing about that oil is it doesn't really behave like normal crude oil, like light crude. It as soon as it hits the water, it basically sinks to the bottom. And there it lays, and the light stuff goes off, but most of it, because it has sand and clay and, you know, bits of stuff in it, is heavier than the water and ends up on the bottom. And and the thing about the Kalamazoo oil spill, I just read a whole thing about it, is that they typically figure costs of cleaning up oil at about $2,000 a barrel to get it to recover.
Wow, that's expensive, yeah.
Yeah, well, this stuff is at this point now costing $29,000 a barrel.
Wait a minute, $29,000 a barrel?
Yeah, well, it's been years, man, and they've picked up. The company says they've cleaned up 700,000 gallons of the 800,000, but that last 100,000 is just costing a fortune because they're basically having to vacuum the bottom of this river, which this stuff has just destroyed. So, anyway, I just thought that. You know, the reason that's interesting to me is because all these trains will be coming along the Columbia, and if there's a serious derailment or a spill,
right.
I mean, that stuff is going to be nearly impossible.
And most of what's going to come along the Columbia is, in fact, that the very oil of which we speak, shale oil.
Shale oil and the tar sands.
And tar sands,
And tar sands out of northern Alberta, which is not really a crude oil. It's basically a bitumen with a bunch of chemicals in it that make it pumpable and, you know, liquefy it. But it's really, really dirty. Okay, go ahead.
No, please finish your thought.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, too, I heard somebody a while ago talking about the effect of coal dust on tracks and why it fouls up the bed. And I think that what happens is it keeps water from draining out from between the ties, and then the ties basically sit in water, and then they rot and they destabilize, and that's what fouls up the bed.
So
I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Sure. It sounds like you're saying a swift response to a spill from a derailment is essential because it becomes not only does the toxicity and the pollution get worse over time, but it becomes more and more expensive to clean it up as time goes by. And there's no plan. We have no plan in place to address a spill from a train derailment.
And they aren't required to have a plan, you know, that they're willing to tell anybody. So that seems like a very bad situation.
My position is even the Oregonian is saying, hey, whoa, look. All right. Anyway, thanks a lot for the call, man.
Thank you.
No problem. Thanks a lot. See,
he's on my side. Callers the world is coming to end.
Callers are on fire today.
Yeah. Another call. Got time?
Yep. Jan, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted to make a comment and maybe observation. What happens to all that dirt, that leftover stuff after removing all that clean, good gasoline from the crude or tar sands, you know?
Yeah.
Most of that junk ends up on our roofs and roads, you know.
This is
the component of bitumen and all the carcinogenics that are on every roof in America. When you travel over America by plane, you see all that tar on a roof.
Those asphalt roofs, as big a town as this big a roof,
you know, Europeans saw that, put solar panels instead that are very good to a roof covering, like in Germany, or they use tiles or something that lasts for 100 years. And this is poison, and water in the perimeter of the house is poisoned by that. You cannot use that roof rainwater for gardening or any other purpose because it's carcinogenic in it. So we waste a lot of water this way. Australia uses sheet metal or ceramic, and they collect that water to flush toilets and other good use, in example.
Yeah,
grass watering. And over here we waste one of the most scarce resources, rainwater from roofs, by having roofs covered with carcinogenic contain, you know, in a bitumen and tar that smells, stinks, and so on. So I'm sorry for the bad news, but the good news, other countries do it right, so maybe we learn from them.
Yeah,
it's possible.
Yeah,
it's
hopefully
possible.
We will.
Well, in fact,
hey, thank you for the call.
Yeah, most of Europe, when they build for hundreds of years, and they do use a ceramic tile, or metal roofs, or roofs that in general will last a long, long time and don't contain all these chemicals. I mean, I've seen them; they're real.
That's a key difference. We ought to look into that. We ought to spend a show talking about the impermanence of a lot of structures in America compared to how long, for the long term, that are built in other countries.
Yes, and this is KBOO, and this is the Abe and Joe Show, and we want you all to stay tuned for the best in news and music.
Hey, thanks for all the great calls today. We'll be back at you next week.
It's come through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On January 14th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals, and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9 o'clock, alternative, which is right now, alternative radio, Sanho Tree on alternative radio. Sanho Tree, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, talks about the end of the drug war. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman reports that the U.S. sailors wounded by Fukushima are getting sicker by the day. And Gareth Porter says former Defense Secretary Robert Gates conceals the real story of gaming Obama on the Afghan War in his new book. At 11 on Stage and Studio, Demae Roberts hosts a preview of David Henry Hwang's play Chinglish. She talks with director May Andralis and actors Tina Chillip and Peter O'Connor about the challenges of a bilingual Chinese-English play. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews Bruce Gunther, chief curator of the Portland Art Museum, about the Francis Bacon portrait of Lucian Freud, which is currently on display at the museum. Thanks for listening to KABU, and thanks KABU members for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become one. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Look, we all know marijuana prohibition will end. It may be 2 years from now, could be 10 years from now, could be 20 years from now, but it's going to end. And so, what is the purpose of prolonging it? Why would we continue to send people into prison, spend all this money, squander all these resources that could be applied toward prevention, to dealing with harder drugs, to, you know, giving access to treatment? All these other needs are not being met because of this waste of money.
That's San Ho Tree, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features San Ho Tree, End the Drug War. In 1971, Nixon launched a war on drugs. He called drug use public enemy number one. Since then, like a recurring nightmare, various presidents have continued the war on drugs. 4 decades on, a consensus has emerged that the war has not only failed, but has ruined countless lives and wasted tons of money. More than $1 trillion has been flushed down the toilet. Despite evidence that punitive measures backfire, our jails and prisons are full of people convicted for smoking cannabis, weed. There are clear signs that attitudes on drugs, particularly marijuana, are shifting. Latin American countries, with Uruguay leading the way, are hitting the reset button. Uruguay has legalized the consumption, sale, and distribution of pot. The time is long past to develop new mechanisms to establish humane and sustainable alternatives to the drug war. To talk about these issues is San Ho Tree. He is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of its Drug Policy Project, which works to end the so-called war on drugs. He has been featured in over a dozen documentary films and has appeared in hundreds of print and broadcast interviews. He spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And now, San Ho Tree.
Before I get into the topic tonight about tipping points in the drug war and ending the drug war, the obvious question comes up, what does it really mean? Does that mean legalization? What does that mean to different people? It's a term that is, it's almost radioactive in a sense, because prohibitionists, drug warriors, have had decades to polarize that word, and many people have different interpretations of what that means. So, and it also speaks to the